This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
Cool girl. Men always use that, don't they? As their defining compliment. She's a cool girl. Cool girl is hot. Cool girl is game. Cool girl is fun. Cool girl never gets angry at her man. She only smiles in a chagrin-loving manner and then presents her mouth for f***ing. She likes what he likes. When I met Nick Dunn, I knew he wanted cool girl. And for him, I'll admit, I was willing to try. I wax-stripped my f***ing raw. I drank canned beer watching Adam Sandler movies. I ate cold pizza and remained a size 2. I blew him semi-regularly. I lived in the moment. I was f***ing game.
BFM 89.9, it is 7:39 and you're listening to Popcorn Culture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. And joining me today, pardon me, it's been a long day, but joining me today in the studio is Sharmila Ganesan.
Hello.
And over Zoom, joining us from home, we have Arvind Yuvaraj.
Hello.
I can't promise that the rest of the show is it's going to be more PC than that. Like, no
less bleeping.
Yes,
much less.
Yes. But the reason why we wanted to start with amazing Amy Dunn is because today we are actually going to be talking about adaptations and movies basically that were adapted from something else. And recently, I think we have examples both incredibly good and incredibly bad. But broadly speaking, David Fincher's Gone Girl is regarded as a success in every which way.
I think Gone Girl is a really interesting start for this discussion because it really gets you thinking about what makes an adaptation work. Because Gone Girl's a really good book on its own regard. It did very well before it even became a movie. And to be fair, as a movie, it's not what you'd call a roaring success. David Fincher's still viewed as more of a slightly left field, not your blockbuster types, but sort of the thinking entertainment or whatever. So for him to decide to do something like a Gone Girl and to do it so well, and I used to think that Gone Girl was such a female story that it would be very difficult for a man to adapt it. So I was really, really pleasantly surprised at how much I liked the movie.
It also sets like a good benchmark for the stuff that we're going to talk about because a lot of the films that we'll bring up, I think, have not been adapted successfully or have omitted a lot of important things from the books, which Gone Girl does. But at the same time, it works as a really, really good film. So on one side, you have like a really good book, but then you can sort of like either censor some parts or tweak some things and change other elements of the book to fit your storyline or your medium. And it can still come out being a very, very good product.
So guys, tell us what your favorite adapted films have been, you know, whether it's adaptations from books or plays or video games. We're seeing all sorts and all sorts of unlikely, I think, sources for silver screen material these days. If you have a favorite or least favorite, we're going to get to both. You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. So I think we should start the show by talking about why. Firstly, I guess, what makes something ripe for an adaptation? But also, why is there this desire in the first place to adapt? I don't want to talk about it from Hollywood's perspective because they're just about money.
Yeah. So
if a book sold well, if a video game's really popular, then you can bet that some Hollywood upstart producer is going to be like, ah, I smell a cash cow. But I think for fans, especially of these books and video games and plays, why do we want to see the movie version of this thing that we already love?
I'm going to say that I don't, more often than not. So I'm going to touch on video games and some kinds of books. So video games, more often than not, I don't want to see movie adaptations of them because I know that you cannot capture everything that's in a video game in a 2-hour, 2.5-hour film. When it comes to books, I feel like unless you are Peter Jackson making Lord of the Rings, and even then with The Hobbit, it wasn't the same, you have to have that level of imagination to either match the imagination of the reader or give them something that they were not expecting, which is very, very difficult to do. And if you cannot, match what they had in their head for, I don't know, a decade or 15 years since they read the book, then you're gonna come out with a subpar adaptation, no matter how hard you try.
I kind of agree in some sense, but I think largely I fall in the I'm game for adaptations camp, as long as they're good adaptations. And I think the pleasure is, and I may be talking about mostly books here, but I think the pleasure is really in seeing a world that you only saw in your mind come alive in person. And whether that's a world or a person or even how a person dressed. I'm thinking about things like Anne of Green Gables, for instance, and how lovely the original adaptation with Megan Follows was, and how much I wanted to see what these people would look like, what they would move like, what they would talk like on screen. And I think there's a real pleasure in, I suppose it's like experiencing something you really love in a different form. There's a great deal of excitement in that.
I find that a separation of church and state is really important for me in this space. So in most spaces. Anyway, and it comes down to this. If I love a book, I am also very protective of the, not just the book, but game, whatever it may be. I end up being very protective as well of the characters that are in my head. So for example, Daniel Radcliffe has never been my Harry Potter, will never be my Harry Potter. Just can't. It can't happen because he's not who I grew up with living in my brain as I read the books. So I think what I appreciate about adaptations is that if you have a good source material, then the possibility of coming up with a solid movie is very high. And so then you get to enjoy the material on two fronts. And I think that's, for me, the main pleasure of an adaptation. Rarely do I read a book and think, you know what I need to see? I need to see a movie. The only time it's happened, I think, has been when the books in question have very, very vivid imagery of certain things where I'm like, you know, this would be much beautiful though the language is, it would make for beautiful visuals. And I think those are the only times. Otherwise, I'm quite happy to just live in my head and then hope for a movie, hope the movie is good in its own right and not compare it to whatever it came before.
So I'm just going to jump in and say, and that's probably why I'm always happy about a Shakespeare adaptation, for instance, because those are plays that are meant to be watched. I mean, they're great as reading material, but really, Shakespeare plays are meant to be watched, performed. And I think that's why they are one of those things that even when they're not great adaptations, I'm always very interested to know how different people would interpret the text.
So we spoke about X-Men on Tuesday, and I think X-Men is like a good example of what we are talking about, especially, Lynn, when you said that you separate the source material and the stuff that comes out on screen. And I think I do the same thing in the sense that when I know something's being adapted, I sort of leave all expectations at the door, or I sort of lower expectations. I don't know if lower is the correct word, but I sort of tweak my expectations and don't wish to see the same things that I saw in the comic books, because then you're just setting yourself up for disappointment. And I think films like X-Men and certain other adaptations taught me to, you know, go into the movie not blind, but go into the movie expecting to see something made for that medium instead of expecting to see something that you think is going to show up on film.
I find that very difficult to do. I know, for instance, you know, I loved the Narnia books. You know, I loved Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And as much as I wanted to tell myself, don't get too invested in it, it's not going to look the way you want it to look, I couldn't. Like, the build-up to watching it on screen was just too much. And by the time I'm getting there, I'm usually, like, really vibrating at a different frequency because I'm like, oh, my God, I get to watch this on screen. I just can't. And yeah, you're right. That does make me then judge it perhaps more harshly than I would something else.
So we're going to be talking after this about adaptations that we love, also adaptations that we simply did not, and what made them successful or otherwise. If you'd like to get in touch and talk to us about your favourite movie that has been adapted from something else, whether it's a book, a play, a game, anything else at all, you can let us know what that is. For that matter, also let us know your least faves. You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bombing frustrated minds. BFM 89.9.
You know what I noticed? Nobody panics when things go according to plan. Even if the plan is horrifying. If tomorrow I tell the press that, like, a gangbanger will get shot, or a truckload of soldiers will be blowing up, nobody panics. Because it's all part of the plan. But when I say that one little old mare will die, well, then everyone loses their minds. Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos. Oh, and you know the thing about chaos? It's beer.
BFM 89.9, it is 7:50 and you're listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin and Sharmila. And today we are talking about film adaptations, so films that were adapted from other source materials. A prime example being the multiple retellings of Batman in movie form, in TV form, in cartoon form, and perhaps, you know, also the Joker, of course, as arch nemesis, perhaps none better than in what we just heard.
Oh, I mean, I haven't watched that movie in about a year or so. And every time I hear Heath Ledger's voice, I'm just reminded of, really, I mean, given that we're talking about adaptations, the challenges of reinventing characters, especially when they've been adapted or presented in so many forms and so many ways. I mean, in some ways, it's actually easier when you're working with comic book characters or tropes because the frame is looser. And there's so many ways you can retell that story. But at the same time, you're also compared to so many iterations of your character.
Yeah. And I think, like, the Joker is one of the best examples because Batman, even though he's been switched around from movie to movie, he's somewhat consistent between the movies. You know, his parents get murdered and he grows up to be Batman and he's a billionaire and he's using his money for technology. But the Joker is a good example of how to take a character and change it according to the movie that he's in. And none of the live action iterations of the Joker have been like they are in the comic books or like the comic book counterpart. The first one in Tim Burton's movie made the cardinal sin of giving him an origin story. You have Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, who's, again, nothing like the comic books. And then you've got, like, Heath Ledger's Joker, which is, like, definitive pop culture Joker.
Are we nothing ignoring, like, Jared Leto?
Yes.
He doesn't exist. Okay. He doesn't exist. But yeah, so it's like definitive Joker, and he's nothing like the ones in the cartoons and the comics. So I think that's another thing. It's like, you know, how do you capture the essence of what you're trying to adapt and successfully put it on film for people to understand? Because if that doesn't happen, then you get Jared Leto's Joker.
Yeah, so I was about to say that it's interesting that you say that the frame with comic books is looser simply because the visual frame is tighter.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Everybody knows what they're supposed to look like, and which is how you get something like Watchmen, where everything looks truly exactly like the comic books. And yet, we can debate this. You know, I don't love that adaptation, but what other adaptations do you guys think have worked and why? Because I think it's a tricky question. Sometimes it's really about they told the story exactly the same way as the book did or exactly the same way as I saw it before and that's what I wanted. Other times it's about capturing a mood, a feeling, a look. You know, there are a lot of things that go into it.
So that's actually an interesting question. And I think if I were to take that need to see what was in the book on screen away, really some of the best adaptations that usually come to mind for me tend to be things other than, like, say, Lord of the Rings, which is always the definitive example. Mm. I actually prefer the ones that take risks or try and capture not exactly the original, but some version of it. I love Hayao Miyazaki's Howl's Moving Castle. But I also really, really love the book that it's based on, Diana Wynne Jones's Howl's Moving Castle. They're very different from each other. Only the bare storyline is kept in the animated version, and yet it's so beautiful. It's such a great adaptation. So I think sometimes not trying to be the original actually works in favor of the adapted product.
Like Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, which
you're talking about, yeah.
Just very quickly, Faizat on Twitter did say Jurassic Park, haha. And also The Count of Monte Cristo, never read the book, but the movie is so much fun. For what it's worth, the book is really fun too.
The Count of Monte Cristo is a great book.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, Arvin, you were saying?
No, like Jurassic Park, where they take liberties with the stories and stuff, and they omit some things from the books. Inherent Vice is another one. Ooh, is another interesting yes. choice. Simply because I don't know how much I like the movie, but I know that they sort of changed a couple of things, but they were able to keep the vibe and the aesthetics and the feel from the book in the movie. And I don't know how they did that, but it was so well done and so well crafted that the movie feels like it came out of the pages of the books. Like it I don't know how to describe it. They feel like text, if that makes any sense. Mm. The movie feels like you're reading the book and you're imagining the scenes on screen.
So that's my favorite kind of surprise, because Inherent Vice, a book by Thomas Pynchon, is not exactly, you know, you don't read that and go, oh, yeah, this is going to be really easy to adapt. It's a very weird, trippy book. Everybody is sort of unlikable and vague. And so, and I think that that translates into the film version. But I love the phrase that you used, well-crafted, because I think in a movie that is made by Paul Thomas Anderson, that is what you'd expect to see. And so that's the best outcome, where you don't necessarily think someone's going to adapt this for sure. They surprise you with a left field choice, and then the outcome is also really interesting.
Yes, and I think because we started with Dark Knight, it also reminded me of another Christopher Nolan adapted film that I really, really like, which is The Prestige.
I love that movie.
Prestige is one of my favorite films of all time. I actually hadn't read the book when I watched the movie. And Prestige does this interesting thing where it kind of uses the same premise as the book, but kind of deviates from it in many ways. So at the end of the day, it's an adaptation of the spirit or the feel of the book more than it is the actual story. But somehow you feel like you're reading the same emotional core. I don't know if that makes sense. And I think it goes back to what Arvind said earlier about Joker, actually, about understanding what is at the heart of the original material rather than doing a word-for-word, frame-for-frame adaptation.
Yeah, because I think if you do that, if you sort of try to do word-for-word or page-for-page, then one, you either end up with something like one of Zack Snyder's movies, or you kind of disrespect two mediums at the same time. Because books are books and, you know, plays are plays, video games are video games, and film has to be film, right? You can't cram everything into like 120 minutes or even if it's like 3 hours long. Unless, again, you're Peter Jackson and you know what to do with your movies, like exactly. If you try to do that, then you're just setting yourself up for failure, I think. I think the best kinds of adaptations are by people who understand that they have a completely different medium and are not supposed to capture everything 100%.
So, just to kind of give a bit of variety to this, one of my favorite adaptations, and it's a movie that I unexpectedly like to return to simply because it's not that comforting. So I don't know why I like it, but I love it so much. It's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is Thomas Alfredson's telling of John le Carré's classic novel of the same name. And it features, I mean, if we start listing the cast, we're going to go on for a while because it's Gary Oldman, you have Benedict Cumberbatch, you have Tom Hardy, you have Mark Strong, Colin Firth. It's just whoever you can think of who you think might be in a Harry Potter film was in this film. And so it's fantastic because the whole movie looks like it's soaked in 70s cigarette smoke. Everything looks kind of like scratchy and smelly and grimy and also beautiful because it's told in that classic detailed Thomas Alfredson way. And it perfectly matches up to the subtleties of the book, which is not a James Bond version of a spy. Instead, it's a spy who is really kind of sad and broken and retired and, you know, has a lot of doubts about the system that he's in. If you gave him a license to kill, he might hand it back. You know, it's that kind of spy. And I just really loved the way the movie managed to capture the story of the book, but also the spirit of the book, the subtlety of it, the fact that this is a sad, slow thing. Mm. And you're not trying to zhuzh it up, you know, even though it is a movie ostensibly about spies.
I love the way you talked about the feel of the movie, what it looked like or what it feels like to live in that, because it also reminded me of the episode we did on world building and why sometimes it's not so much. So when you think of the Harry Potter movies, I agree, I'm not particularly invested in the children, for instance. But what I do like is the way the world feels. When I was lucky enough to visit Harry Potter World a few years ago, stepping into the theme park feels the way it did in my head. The movies similarly also feel the way they do in my head. And I think understanding the what cinema can bring to the table, which is that element of creating a world, is really important.
So let us know your favourite adaptations, your favourite film adaptations. We're getting messages. We'll get to them after the 8 o'clock news. You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Your face is familiar. Weren't you in the 3rd Division during the war?
Oh, yes, the 9th Battalion.
I was in the 7th.
Excuse me. I knew you looked familiar. You're having a good time, old sport.
Oh, the whole thing's incredible. I live just next door. He sent me an actual invitation. Seems I'm the only one. I still haven't met Mr. Gatsby.
No one's met him. They say he's 3rd cousin to the Kaiser and 2nd cousin to the devil.
I'm afraid I haven't been a very good host, old sport. You see, I'm Gatsby.
BFM 89.9, it is 8:08. You're listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin and Sharmila. Tonight we're talking about adaptations, so films that came from source materials, including just really anything they come from. They could be from the back of a, I don't know, a toothpaste.
Or a theme park ride,
yes,
like Pirates.
Like Pirates, exactly. Oh no, are we going to have to talk about that? How well did they adapt a ride? I can't even begin to assess that. But I think that just before we move on, I think it's worth talking about classics before we get to some of the messages that we're getting, simply because classics are, I think, some of the most adapted and then remade films. So Gatsby, for instance, which we just heard, that was Baz Luhrmann's take in, I don't know, I forget when now, 2000-something.
And
2013, thank you. And so that did a very kind of obvious, in-your-face, lavish, Beyoncé's going to write a song for this kind of approach to Great Gatsby. And it speaks to, I think, the different ways that you can identify themes within books or within the source material and then base your whole movie around what you think the point is. Mm. So Gatsby is a good example of that.
So I was very, very disappointed. I love the book Great Gatsby, and I love Baz Luhrmann. Baz Luhrmann's one of my favorite filmmakers, and because of how much I loved his adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, yes, I thought Great Gatsby was going to be phenomenal, because I couldn't think of anyone more suited to adapt that style, the Roaring Twenties, the excesses, the underlying pain and whatever. But I ended up not even watching the movie because of how badly it was reviewed, including from people who loved the book and hated the movie. I think, Lynn, you might be one of them.
My mouth got a little tight while the clip was playing. I apologize.
I actually didn't mind it. I didn't mind the movie so much. I think, again, it goes back to, you know, what you expect from film and what you expect from the books. And I feel like Baz Luhrmann sort of allowed his imagination to go a bit crazy with the colors and the way he even shoots the thing, with the cinematography. It's all very super dreamy and like, you know, what is in your head? And if I woke up in the middle of the night having like a lucid dream, this is the stuff that I would pen down in my diary. It's that kind of a movie. So at the end of the day, I see it as like two separate things. Like, the movie is the movie. I don't mind it. It's not good, but it's not bad. And the book is the book, which is, you know, it is one of the books that you can read.
Speaking of the books and the adaptations, I'm just going to run through quite a few. So Xiong An says, Lord of the Rings, it's absolutely precious and a marvel in movie making. Sorry, I could have done the hiss, but I held back. We also, Lord of the Rings is not, or rather, Xiong An is not the only person to bring up Lord of the Rings. We also have Ken Ling, who's saying, favourite, still Lord of the Rings, another great, V for Vendetta. Least favourite, The Golden Compass. Even worse, Dragon Ball Evolution.
I'm with you on The Golden Compass. I hate that adaptation so much.
Can we talk about V for Vendetta for a couple of seconds? Because that's a good example of a movie that had to be confined to its ratings and sort of, you know, because they couldn't show all the violence and all the themes that the graphic novel had, it had to be diluted to reach a wider audience. So I think that's another thing that comes into play when you adapt stuff. It's like, who are you making it for? Mm. And is the audience big enough and are they going to watch it? And what kind of budget is going to go into this big studio production? Because it is a Warner Brothers production. At the end of the day, because they wanted more people to see it, V for Vendetta, as much as I like that movie, came out not being as gritty and as violent as it should have been.
And not as complex, actually, because the book, the book is super, super complex and is... the usual kind of style of political commentary that you would expect from its author. So I think that the movie just kind of couldn't capture that. Also still on Lord of the Rings, we have occasional guests and just BFMer Dashrin Johan saying, oh, this is tough. Harry Potter is perhaps the most important one to me, followed by Get On It, Arvin. And can't deny Lord of the Rings, pretty much a perfect adaptation. But I think the harshest criticism of Lord of the Rings comes from Sharon on Twitter, who says, "This is hard. I know a great many books that I wished were never made into movies. Get this, but I guess Lord of the Rings wasn't too bad."
Oh, high standard.
Wow. I want Sharon, wasn't too bad.
I know. I want Sharon to get back in touch. I think maybe we need to be harsher critics, guys.
Mm-hmm. But you know, Lord of the Rings actually had many detractors. There were people who were really unhappy about the things that were left out. They were really unhappy that Arwen was swapped in for the actual character who rescued Frodo, I think.
I don't think... I've never met anybody who's a fan of the Arwen storyline. I will say that. I know that it had to happen. Again, we've talked about this. Lord of the Rings is a huge book. It eventually became, depending on what you watched, either a 10-hour experience or a 12-hour experience if you wanted to watch all of them. And so I understand that in the interest of time, you're going to have to cut stuff. I think some of the cuts are very neat. I understand them. I think that it's great. Nobody wants to be at Council of Elrond for 40 minutes, so fine. Arwen, on the other hand, I will never agree with.
No, it wasn't my favorite, but I will say that Lord of the Rings, probably on the scale of Lord of the Rings to Golden Compass, you know, it probably has its least detractors as far as adaptations go.
Gosh, why are we ignoring Dragon Ball Evolution?
Because that's in its own league. It's like the best of the best.
Okay, so we also have a point being... So along with Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter is the other one that's being mentioned, right? So Dash did that, but we also have another tweet that identifies themselves as forever a Potterhead. Meanwhile, we have Magat Aiman saying, "Love the movie still, but sometimes feel like Harry Potter could do so much as a series rather than a movie."
Ooh, interesting. And I think that's actually something that we are seeing more and more of, because I just think sometimes TV does better with certain kinds of books in terms of adaptation and having the space, as we see with Game of Thrones. The Foundation series by Asimov, for instance, has never been made into anything, and only talk of it has come recently because of prestige TV. So I think that's an interesting idea.
Not just prestige TV, right, but also teen TV. Mm-hmm. Because the thing about Harry Potter is that... maybe, I don't know if anybody wants to watch this, but what about Hogwarts when Harry is away? So like, we always follow Harry, you know, we know what happens to the guy. But maybe a Hogwarts thing focusing on Neville's adventures in the greenhouse. I don't know, like, I don't know if anyone else wants to watch that. I'd watch it.
I was going to say, that's what happens when you give people too much space. They start telling too many stories that other people don't want to watch.
Yeah, I don't have the money to make it, so don't worry.
You know, it's like if you give someone, let's say, 10 hours, I don't want to keep basing things off Peter Jackson because he got way too much leeway and not everyone gets that kind of budget or that kind of, you know, the kind of space to make your movies.
And also we need to talk about the fact that there's Lord of the Rings, there's also The Hobbit. So he didn't get it right every time.
Yes, but I think there's also a beauty of giving someone like 3 hours max or 2.5 hours or whatever the commercial, you know, optimum is, and making them sort of translate a book or play or musical into that format. There is a beauty in seeing them come up with creative ways to fit all of that into like a movie's format and see, and you know, just seeing how that works. Because if like a series, and if it goes on for maybe like 5-6 seasons, there's a huge chance that they may take liberties, I'm talking about Game of Thrones, with the source material, and it could go off the, you know, it could go off on tangents, and it could just go off in a way that people don't necessarily like.
We have Thevin, by the way, who says, you know, when it comes to, if we're talking about books, how about Scott Pilgrim versus the World? I feel like this movie is so underrated in Malaysia. The way the film uses video game fighting style really adapted comic book imagery. And look, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, I know, is kind of a cult classic that its fans will always feel that it is not loved enough. And maybe that's fair, because if you rewatch Scott Pilgrim, it is so much fun, and it really does manage to capture the visual style of the book incredibly well.
Mm. Oh, I love Scott Pilgrim, but it reminded me of Kick-Ass, actually, and how much I loved that movie when it came out, and how and that goes back to also what you were saying earlier, Arvind, about this notion of something being sanitized because it wants to reach a larger audience. Kick-Ass is a great example of how they chose not to go that route, because to have a preteen girl with, you know, a potty mouth and with that amount of violence happening on screen was a risk. But I think that's another example of how when you take those kinds of risks, sometimes they can pay off.
Yeah. And sometimes you just have to, it's perfectly balanced, like the Hunger Games, you know, you find a way to make it as not disturbing, but as dark as the books. But at the same time, you make it commercial enough that it makes a lot of money. It made like $1 billion or something at the box office, one of Catching Fire and the other one after that. Mm. But yeah, so there's sometimes they are able to nail that fine line and get the balance right. And you do justice to the source material, but you also make like movies that a lot of people want to watch.
Okay. I'm just going to jump in because Sharmila has a lot to say about Hunger Games, I think. So we'll get to that after the ads. But also, just this last one from JY Tan, who tweets, I have several favorites, but I would like to bring attention to J.A. Bayona's film adaptation of Patrick Ness's A Monster Calls, a beautiful, emotional movie that understands and is faithful to the core themes of the book with strong visual storytelling. I've always wanted to watch this movie, and I've always sidestepped it because I'm worried that it will wreck me. So
it is that kind of movie.
It did. But I believe all the good things that people are saying. I just need to be in the right headspace. Let us know your favorite adaptations. You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
I understand. You found paradise in America. Had a good trade, made a good living, police protected you, and there were courts of law. And you didn't need a friend like me. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
BFM 89.9, it is coming along to 8:21. You're listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin and Sharmila and Don Corleone. Today, we're talking about adaptations, so movies that have been adapted from other source materials, whether it's books, plays, video games, all sorts. And The Godfather was, of course, adapted from The Godfather by Mario Puzo. And in this section, what we wanted to do was talk about adaptations that we think actually surpass the source material. Before we get to that, just to close a loop, because we are getting, we did have one that I think we didn't mention earlier, which is 13 Hours as an adaptation that they liked a lot.
Well, I haven't watched it, so I can't comment, but
I've seen it, but I don't know the source material. So I think it's one of those things.
Yeah, same. I was thinking for a moment, I thought it was the one with James Franco. Mm-mm. Where he gets stuck in the cave, but no, that's 127 hours.
Yes, quite a few more hours there.
You need to multiply. Okay, yeah. But so back to what we were talking about. When we tweeted our question today, what's your favorite adaptation? We included a GIF of Katniss Everdeen and her famous, you know, kind of three-fingered salute. And Sharmila, I'm just gonna unleash you.
So I don't dislike the books. I actually really liked, especially the first Hunger Games book. But I think as far as the theme of this particular, what we're talking about now, in terms of movies that actually ended up being superior to what they were based on, I think Hunger Games is a great example. Because a couple of things that in the book, for instance, Katniss is... I'm fine with there being unlikable heroines, but Katniss to me was unlikable to the point of being almost unreadable at times.
Katniss is difficult in the extreme.
And also just the story, for some reason, feels very repetitive and uninspired as the second and third book kick in. Whereas I felt like the movies ran with the basic plot line, but just in terms of the visuals, the performances really elevated the story. So I think The Hunger Games is a great example of how solid source material can actually be made into something that's a lot better than what it started out as.
If you think about it, she could have been really annoying in the movies as well because was Jennifer Lawrence. Yeah.
I think Jennifer Lawrence did a great job with Katniss, though.
She did. She did. She's like super likable and she carries that movie on her back, like all through, like from movie one to movie four.
Not just that, but I think going back to something that I'd mentioned right at the start of our show, which is that sometimes you read something and you think, I'd like to see that. Mm. The Hunger Games falls into that category because it's sort of a sports movie if, you know, the loser gets death. but it's got that kind of sports movie structure. It's got an amazing sort of dome in which the Hunger Games actually take place. All the different districts are also very cinematic. So actually, The Hunger Games falls into the category of a book that as I was reading it, I thought, yeah, you know, this one, I would actually like to see it. Partly also because I think, like you rightly point out, Sharmila, there are some issues with the language of the writer where maybe watching a movie is a more pleasant experience for the story.
YA is particularly a genre that now many writers really write to be adapted because it's become such a cash cow. So many YA and children's books get adapted into TV shows and movies that I think there is a particular tendency for YA and children's writers to now write books that feel cinematic.
Mm, yes, that's very true. I also just wanted to say that The Godfather, because we opened with that and the infamous, I mean, I don't know how many pieces of cotton he stuffed in his mouth to achieve the signature Don Corleone look and sound. But the book is great fun. We've talked about this on our other show before by the book, and it's great fun. It's pulpy. It's kind of very in your face and entertaining. But the movie is art. I think that there is a difference here. I mean, the actual outlines of the story and the characters from book to movie are very similar, but the finesse with which the story is told, I think, does elevate Godfather, the movie, I think, to be something quite distinct from the book.
Actually, if you know, that clip is like, it made me think about how you always think about sound when reading books. It's different when you're watching stuff on stage and if it's a play, but if you're reading a book, the one thing missing from the book is sound, and you don't know what their voices sound like. You don't know if there's music, you don't know the surroundings. And I think it's similar for Hunger Games and for Godfather. If you read that dialogue on a piece of paper, there's no way you could have imagined it sounding like that, just mumbling his way through all those lines, but also being like super iconic in the way that he mumbles. And when it comes to Hunger Games, you know, there's no way you could have sort of imagine that the sound, that gong that hits every time someone dies.
The tune that plays.
The whistle.
Yeah, or that...
The whistle, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, or the Hanging Tree song. There are just so many... You're right. That's a really good point.
Yeah, the sound. So it's sound and music. I think those are two things that you just cannot structure in your head as much as you can visuals. Maybe the visuals don't live up as much. But if a movie has good sound and if it has someone who's composing like a really good score, those are two things that can sort of elevate an adaptation higher than its source material.
I wanted to also add to that Atticus Finch played by Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird.
You mean just Atticus Finch?
Of course.
He's kind of the signature Atticus Finch.
But again, I read To Kill a Mockingbird first, but it was when I watched him perform that he came to life in my head. This is how he sounds. This is how he would pause when making a courtroom argument. And I think those things are really important.
Can I just jump in here with a WhatsApp from Danny who says, Iron Man the movie floored me as a longtime comic book fan. The comics were great, but Tony Stark, the comics had nothing on Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yes, and I think it speaks to what we were saying about voice. Because now I think Robert Downey Jr. over the years has had so many iconic lines as Iron Man, including in the most recent Avengers. And now I think that if I were to see an Iron Man comic book, I would hear him. I don't think there's any other way. He's the voice that I would hear. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. It's like it's definitive. So there is a list that keeps going around the internet of like 10 actors who are almost Iron Man. I think Tom Cruise came very close. Sam Rockwell came very close. A couple of others Sam Rockwell.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, which is why he was Justin Hammer in the second movie.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He slipped the chance. But, you know, there's a list of all these people who almost played Iron Man. And you're right. You know, I cannot picture any of them being the voice of either Tony Stark or behind the mask, which is like super important, because if you get that part wrong, then you're gonna end up making something that goes against what you have in your head or just sounds wrong for the character that you're trying to bring on screen.
This goes back to what we were saying earlier in the week also about Wolverine, because that whole Hugh Jackman could have been on one of those lists if somebody else had played Wolverine, simply because he wasn't the first choice. Mm. And yet, again, despite being far too tall to play Logan, he is far too nice in real life, yes. He really has that sort of signature. It's a signature role. You know, that's the one he's wedded to. And I think in many ways, it's a good adaptation, even if they had gotten another Wolverine. But he really does also help to make it, you know, it comes together around him.
But speaking of sound, I was actually reminded of Jaws, because Jaws, many people don't realize, was a book. Kind of a pulpy, not quite A-grade, B-grade kind of novel. But what is Jaws without that soundtrack, right? What is Jaws without that theme song? And so I think that speaks to that idea that sometimes a film really works when it brings something to the original that it never could have done in the first place.
Well, I think if you have John Williams, then it's like you, by default, it's probably going to be better than the book. I mean, there's no way you can think like, oh, I could have thought of a better soundtrack than John Williams. Like, no, it's not happening. So if anyone else, it's debatable. But the moment John Williams is like on your like IMDb page, I think you're in safe hands.
It's the gun to a knife fight thing. It's like, oh, what do you want to raise me? I raise you John Williams, you know, and then it's just, that's it. I will also just point out that there are some recurring names that, directorially anyway, that we haven't really said. But we spoke about Jurassic Park earlier. Now we're talking about Jaws. And in both instances, it's Steven Spielberg. And so genre is a part of it. There are also some things that, like we're talking about, if you're going to adapt it, add something. So if you're going to adapt Jaws, add the soundtrack, you know, add Bruce, do the whole thing. If you're going to do, if you're going to do Jurassic Park, build me a T-Rex, you know? Yeah. So I think it's these sorts of extraness. It's that extra love and care of the material that really adds up. Also, we have somebody, let me find it. We have a tweet that says Chuck Palahniuk's Fight Club, which was brought to screen by David Fincher, who also has done, of course, what did we say now?
When we were on the break, we were actually saying, so he's done Social Network, which is an adaptation.
Gone Girl.
He's done Gone Girl, which is an adaptation. He's done Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Even Zodiac is an adaptation of the nonfiction book, The Zodiac Killer. So David Fincher, actually, I should know this because I'm a big fan, but somehow it never connects in my head that he's actually done so many adaptations until you sit down and think about it. And I think he is actually one of those filmmakers that is able to bring that something extra to a material. He has a distinctive visual style. He thrives on finding that seedy underbelly of a story. And I think it really works for stories of a particular kind.
You know what we haven't spoken about? How the people who came up with the original source material normally don't end up liking the stuff that's adapted. Not all of them, but a lot of names that we threw out on today's show, Watchmen, V for Vendetta, they are not liked by the people who made the original stuff. And I'm thinking about stuff like The Shining.
Yeah, which famously. Famously.
Stephen King disowned that movie outright.
Stephen King is both one of the most adapted authors of all time, but also one of the most badly adapted authors of all time. I just feel like many people don't get what makes his books so amazing.
And yet they keep making It movies and doing it well. Why is this world the world of my nightmares? I don't understand.
I mean, you would think a Dark Tower would work and an It second adaptation wouldn't, but no, it's the reverse that happens.
No, but that's the thing. See, he vouched for Dark Tower. but he didn't like The Shining. So sometimes it's a case of what do the authors want from their adaptations? You know what I mean? Like, what is their worldview? Why didn't he like The Shining? Because on like every front, The Shining's a good movie. Like, it's a really good movie. It may not be a good adaptation, but it's a good film. And Stanley Kubrick, like, you know, it's Stanley Kubrick. But when you can vouch for something like The Dark Tower, even though it wasn't a good adaptation, you have to wonder, like, what did they envision in their minds when they thought if this would become a film or this would become a different production or exit their medium?
I think it's the J.K. Rowling writing Fantastic Beasts curse. I sometimes think that the person who created the initial material isn't the best person to kill their own darlings.
Yeah. So I agree with that, and I think that I would just gently point out that Stephen King also liked Dr. Sleep, which I think is a good movie. So the taste kind of runs the gamut on this. Is there anything that you guys want to see? Is there anything that you want to see made that hasn't been made?
Oh, Foundation, for sure. Isaac Asimov's Foundation. It's one of my favorite book series of all time.
I'm going to go to some, it has to be some graphic novel, but nothing's coming to mind yet. It has to be something graphic novel. It has to be something Batman, and I want to see it rated R. I've always wanted to see like a rated R Batman, not a Zack Snyder Batman, but
wants that. No,
no, but like a rated R Batman based on one of his more famous novels and done properly. So that's something that I really want to see.
Yvonne just said Neil Gaiman's Sandman, which we are waiting on. I think there's a long list before we get to that. But there is, I think it's out on Audible right now, the audio version of Sandman with Neil Gaiman as the narrator and like
James McAvoy.
67 actors, I believe it is. So Yvonne, if nothing else, there is that. What I want to see already exists, and it is Preacher. I haven't. it's something that from the very beginning, when I first read it, from the very first page, the premise itself, I was like, somebody needs to make this. He looks like Elvis. I want you to find the actor who's going to play me, Jesse Custer. And then they got Dominic Cooper, and then I didn't watch it. So I think this is one of those.
So sometimes you don't want your dreams to come true.
This is what I'm saying. No. Despite the fact that I hear all around that Preacher is a good show, people really enjoy it. But I think I have such a deep love for the comic books, and I weirdly want a Zack Snyder treatment for this in that I want him to just make the thing, just make it exactly the same as the book. So I don't know. Maybe I just have to reconcile to the fact that I'll never get what I want. Yeah, such is life. Okay, so keep those thoughts coming. What are your favorite adaptations? And also, is there an adaptation that you wish were coming out that isn't yet? You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. If something occurs to you maybe a little bit later on, you can write to us at movies@bfm.my or find us on Twitter and Instagram at BFM Popcorn. This has been Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.